Okay, let's get going here. Hour number three tonight. Let's find out what happens in this hour. It's been a very strange day, and lots of different things happening all the time, and we all better get used to it because it's not going to slow down. Things are changing at warp speed. They are not lagging, and it's by design. It's part of the plan. So buckle your seatbelts. It's going to be a very bumpy ride. We have some very important news this hour. We're going to talk about big medicine, big organized professional health type medicine, and hospitals in particular, and what's going on in hospitals. That in and of itself is changing very rapidly. It is not stagnant. It is, I think, out of control. We're going to find out with a very special guest in just a couple of minutes. Erica, are you there?
I'm here, Jeff. Good evening.
Good evening. Erica Kahn is always back just in time to save me from my medical and scientific ignorance. But we've been at this for a long time to try to help all of you make better decisions. It's not easy, and I want to underscore this. I speak always for myself, and a lot of this is what I call speculative science. It's predicated on real science, but we don't know enough about the bioweapon yet to make any really sweeping claims of accuracy. We've come close. Erica has done more than anyone else in the media, in my view, to help us really get a grasp on how evil and diabolical this weapon is. Remember, this was ordered, created, tested, proven, and deployed. There's nothing experimental about this bioweapon at all. It's doing what it was designed to do. The only question I have is who really put it together? Was it all humans? Did humans get a little nudge from some of their ET counterparts? I think that's a possibility. I don't know. We'll never know for sure. But it's a bad, bad thing. And I've mentioned earlier tonight a couple of stories I heard today about that. We're going to talk to a professional healthcare provider, a nurse, who works in a major hospital tonight about what's going on there. But before we jump into that, Erica, where are we in this horror show that we're currently enmeshed in? Where do you see us?
I think they're prepping us for another lockdown of sorts. I'm hearing reports from the local health authorities, public health authorities, that the cases are spiking again. The question is, you know, cases of what? And they will not admit that it's vaccine-induced injury. They're telling us that it's a surge in COVID, and that we should all go and get vaccinated if we haven't. And certainly, if we've been vaccinated, then we should really consider having the booster. I mean, the level of fraud is astonishing.
It's all lies.
To sit there and tell the public with a straight face that we should get a vaccine that's killing people.
Well, it's murder is what it is. These people are all accessories to murder.
Anybody getting behind this now is completely complicit in this.
Accessories to murder. And I do include most of the two-thirds of the professional health care givers and providers who are actively involved in this vaccine program, so-called, and who are actively involved in putting remdesivir in IV drip bags in hospitals, knowing damn well it'll kill the kidneys and send the people into a ventilator and then off to the morgue. That's what happens.
Yep.
Remember last year, there were 2,300 cases of influenza. The year before, there were over 50 million. Where did those cases go? They were simply renamed COVID. It's all lies. You've got to understand that by now. I know all of you do, or you wouldn't be listening to this program. And welcome to you newcomers wherever you are around the world. It's all lies in our country and in yours. There are no exceptions. This is a worldwide genocide.
Yeah, it's scandalous at this point. And I really pity the people that are still buying the lie.
All right, well, let me repeat the one. There was a doctor I know who told me today that a karate master, had a relative, we'll just leave it at that, who got a shot yesterday. We don't know if it's a first, second, or a booster, or the fifth, or sixth, or seventh, or tenth shot. We don't know. But that person died today, the next day, dead. Someone else found someone, another doctor, a woman doctor, dead. People are dying, and they're covering this up all over the place. And it's easy to do. They've hidden over 2 million deaths, murders in this country. And I think they could probably hide 20 million. They own the media. If it isn't reported on the media, it doesn't exist for most people. Sad but true. That's the way the game is played. Yesterday, 8 different professional nursing organizations ordered all of their members, nurses, male and female, not to talk in any way negatively about the so-called vaccine or anything to do with what's going on here. Just to shut your mouth or you're out. So that's the kind of communist totalitarianism we're seeing being implemented all over the map here in this country. All over the map. It's not specially found in one area or another. It's everywhere I look, I see this. Mandates.
The fact that this is an experimental injection, it's not FDA approved. It's merely authorized for emergency use. Anyone that takes it is considered a human subject in participating in an experimentation. And then, there is legislation to protect the rights of people that volunteer for this type of thing, one of which is full disclosure and informed consent. So nobody's really enforcing that.
No one's enforcing anything unless it serves their purposes. This is not, in my view, in any way an experiment. This is a deployment of a weapon. They know what they're doing. Experimentally, yes, according to the protocols of the CDC and so forth, but it's not. They know what they have, and they know how it works. Am I right?
At this stage of the game, yes. It's undeniable what it is. It's killing people. It's crippling them. It's maiming them.
They're ruined for life. Coast to coast, I am told that almost all, you told me this, all the NICUs, NICUs, tell our listeners what you found out.
The latest is infants that are being born to women who took the vax while pregnant are being born now and filling the NICUs, the neonatal intensive care units of hospitals, with infants that have heart damage.
But don't worry, Erica, their hearts will heal up and new cells will form and they'll be just fine, right?
Yeah, well, they're still pushing the vaccine on pregnant women.
Here's the point. When your heart is damaged, and Erica's talked about this many times, it doesn't recover. It's permanent damage. Your heart doesn't regenerate with all new cells when they're damaged. These children, these infants, these toddlers, and now the 5 and 6, 7, 8-year-olds are being permanently damaged. Their lives are shortened. And how long they'll live, I don't know. And not much longer. These people are being killed.
Yeah, systematically, routinely killed.
Okay, well, we have a great pleasure tonight to talk to someone who has been a professional for many years in the nursing field. And as I think many of you know, nurses are the backbone of the whole health industry here in many ways. She is named Anne. She has offered to come forward and tell us what she is seeing in the hospital. She was just off work for I guess 6-7 weeks, something like that, with an injury. She's back at work. She wasn't ill, so she went back to the hospital. And what she told me on the phone today was that things have changed violently. They are not the same as when she left 7 or 8 weeks ago. Anne, can you hear me all right? Are you there?
Yes, I can.
Thank you so much for coming on the program, Anne. I really appreciate it. Anne works in the southern part of the country. I'm going to leave it right there. So we don't need that. We just need the information. Tell us about your career. When did you start? How many years have you been at nursing?
So I graduated nursing in 1996, so I'm over 26 years now as a practicing nurse. And I went into working in the ICU unit pretty about 5 years in my career. And I've continued to work in the intensive care unit and the cardiac step-down units going on throughout my life. I was a travel nurse, so I would take assignments in various states and wherever the greatest need was, that's where the hospital would place me. But more often than not, I was floated to the intensive care unit because I had that background and that experience already.
You've seen it all.
Pretty much, yeah. Pretty much.
All right.
Well, I thought I had until I saw this last year,
yeah.
Actually.
Okay. Let me just rewind a little bit. You had an injury, which wasn't terrible, but it kept you out of work for, 7 or 8 weeks, was it? How long,
yeah.
Approximately?
Yeah, I was lifting heavy patients because of, I was working in the ICU, and because they're comatose because of the type of medication that we have to administer, that while they're on ventilators, they cannot assist us. So we were lifting all of these patients who at that time last year were extremely obese. And it was a constant struggle. And ultimately I injured my back and got 3 herniated discs. So it took me out of work for the greater part of 2 to 3 months.
Right. Okay. Thank you for that. Now you said something which I'm sure all of you out there listening heard. She said obese at the time. And I can assure you they didn't all go on diets and having lost a lot of weight, having gone back into the hospital now, look thin and fit. So when you went back to work, what did you see that wasn't there 8 weeks ago?
So the hospital that I am now currently working in is a bigger institution and has a lot more intensive care units. And they also have COVID-specific units also.
Uh-huh.
And the sickest of the sick of the COVID patients will end up in either the ICU or the medical ICU or the NICU, or it'll always be in the intensive care units. So
I see.
I took the position and I was expecting what I had saw last year, and I was quite shocked when I went to the unit to discover it wasn't the same thing. I wasn't seeing the same thing anymore. It was different.
Let me hold it right there. I want to introduce you to Erica Kahn, who is my sidekick in this endeavor to help inform people. She is here, so she's very keen on this, too. And say hello to Erica, Anne, if you would.
Yes, hello, Erica.
Hi, Anne. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
All right. So Anne goes back to work, and she's shocked. In 7 weeks, 8 weeks, what happened, Anne? What did you see?
So, to compare last year to this, what I'm seeing now, the population is much younger that's becoming really sick. And it's a different type of sickness that's bringing them to the hospital this time.
How much younger? What are we talking about?
So the ranges go from 20 to 50 or 60.
Right.
So last year when we were dealing with this, we were dealing with a population that was much older. They were well over into their 70s and 80s. and they were the patients that had still a full code status, so they would end up in our intensive care unit, mm-hmm. and we would be doing everything for them. And at that time, they were presenting with respiratory issues.
Primarily,
they would
pneumonia, that kind of thing?
Yeah, primarily the pneumonia, difficulty breathing, they would be hypoxic. They would have had some, as because of the age they were, they would have come with comorbidities, such as maybe they were smokers. We had a lot of problems with the patients who had previously been smokers or had asthma or had previous heart histories, cardiac histories, or I'm trying to think if there was one other one in there. No, and to my shock last year, because I observed this, the people who were getting treated for cancer never were in my unit, ever. So the medication that they were giving to treat the cancer patients was keeping the cancer patients out of ICU.
Interesting. All right, so 8 weeks you go in, and those people, those 70-year-olds, let's just round it off, with often mm-hmm. respiratory issues, they're not there. The obese people are not there. You've got 20, 30, 40, 50-year-olds there. You must have just scratched your head and said, how could this be? Who are these people? Where'd they come from?
It was absolutely quite a shock to me. When I went on the unit, first of all, I walked in to an environment that we're very severely understaffed because nurses were let go. So because of their refusal to take the vaccination. And so we were already short-staffed, and we were exceptionally, the ratios from nurse to patient was exceptionally high. In fact, I would say dangerous.
What is it supposed to be, Anne?
So in ICU, your max would have been 1 to 2 patients in a very critical ICU.
Okay.
If they push it to 3. So in this scenario, we are now looking at having 6-7 patients potentially.
And per nurse?
Per nurse.
Now, people are wondering how you got into the hospital without being vaccinated.
Yes, and some of the companies will accept a religious exception.
Very good.
So I had presented a religious exception, and they will allow that in certain parts of the country. They'll allow it, but then there are certain parts, states where it's an absolute requirement that you have it, and you present it to the agency you work for plus the hospital that you will work for.
All right. So in some cases, that still works. Well, that's good to hear. Okay. We've got all these 20 to 50-year-olds. Are you seeing pediatrics in your ICU work?
So I was primarily on the adult ICU unit.
Mm-hmm.
I am aware that the PEDS ICU unit was full to capacity, and they actually could not take any more PEDS patients. They would have had to divert to another area hospital.
So the hospital was actually that full that they would have had to reject new incoming patients and refer them to another facility. That's not good.
Yes.
That's a very big surprise. You must have been shocked at this.
I was, actually. I was pretty horrified at what I witnessed when I went back. It hits home for me because I have nieces and nephews, and they have just had their young babies. And after I left the hospital that first morning, I called them and I said, I beg you not to give the children the vaccination. But for what I'm seeing now, I'm begging you not to do it.
What did they say?
Well, the parents themselves said that they would not. Now, unfortunately, some of my siblings and I are at odds because they feel quite strongly about it. I come from a big family, and they feel very strongly that they will protect their kids. My other siblings had said, yes, I took it, but I will not allow them to vaccinate my child.
This is very sad to hear. Families broken often irrevocably by these rules and regulations and lies, which is what they really are. And then we have children now being played with like they're toys, cartoon characters telling them to get their shots, and they'll be given superpowers if they get their shots. And the wickedness of these ad campaigns to convince children to actually go against the will of their parents in some cases is astounding to me.
Yeah, it is. It shocks me. It horrifies me every day when I see parents who are going to put some little kid through this experimental vaccination that they had no knowledge of what was going to come, even with the adult dosage at the time, and to turn around and give it to children who they're just building their immune system up at this point. And then unfortunately I accidentally have encountered a really sad case when I had to go to the PEDS ICU unit, because on my floor I had to give a particular drug to a patient, and it needed to be in a syringe, so it needed a mini infuser pump to do it, and that's all they use in the PEDS ICUs for the most part, because the dosages for the drugs should be
that's
smaller.
That's pediatrics you're talking about, PEDS, right?
Correct, yes.
Okay.
Correct. So I went down, and I was down there, and I was waiting to get assistance from the nurse who works the unit. And while I was waiting, I walked around the unit, and the patients that were in that unit at that time ranged all the way from little infants, neonates, to infants, to two-year-olds, and up to 5 years old. So while I was waiting, I was just, you know, I was just looking at some of the patients, and I happened to be there when a mother was talking to the doctor, and she was saying that she was so happy she had vaccinated her son because he doesn't have to worry about COVID. And the nurse who was actually giving me the pump that I was waiting for, she was in that particular patient's chart, and she was the nurse that night. And I was looking, waiting for her to give me the information, and she got that poor child in there had a heart attack at 5 years of age.
5 years of age, a heart attack.
Yeah.
Incredible. And probably not the only one by far.
No, they're seeing a lot of endocarditis coming up with children.
Mm-hmm.
That seems to be a problem. And then one of the very sad cases there is an infant, and they're from my previous neurological ICU. We used to put the adult patients on this intracranial pressure monitoring. And it's been invasive. It's an invasive machine. It's the tube put in, they bore a hole in the skull of the brain, and then they measure the readings that is fed into a computer system at the bedside. So an infant was on that particular machine. And in my lifetime, I've never seen an infant on intracranial pressure monitoring.
When you say infant, Anne, how old approximately?
Oh, this patient would have probably been only a couple of months.
So this suggests the mother got the vax during pregnancy?
Yeah. That's what I would seem to think from how young that the patient
understand.
Actually was.
Yeah, understand. Erica, go ahead, please.
Yeah, that's consistent with the reports I'm seeing as well, with these mothers that took the vax while pregnant. There seems to just be a plethora now of infants being born with these cardiac issues.
Yeah, I agree. The cardiac issues was predominantly the biggest reason for those admissions. But I had not seen that intracranial bleeds in the infants. But to my shock horror, on my adult ICU unit, everybody
wow.
had some form of a bleed in their temporal lobe area region and of their brain, and they would have seizures that they never had before. And the majority of the people that I took care of that night were stroke patients. They had a stroke.
These are new strokes. These strokes just happened, and they were rushed into the hospital, that kind of thing?
Yeah, the one young man that I spoke with, he was only in his 40s, and he had young children, and he was happily married, and he had seizures, which he'd never had before. That ultimately brought him into the hospital. And by the time he had hit the ER doors, he had not only had his seizures going on, now he was actively stroking out as well. And so he has weakness on one side of his body now, but his speech, his speech is clear, it's appropriate. They're constantly watching him for active seizures. So he's on heavy doses of seizure medication. And this man is not obese. He's very fit. He's taken care of himself all his life. He was never a smoker. But what he did do was he took the vax. And that was the one thing that he did that he changed his whole life.
Do we know how long ago he took the shot approximately?
Oh, yeah. He told me he took the, under the pressure of his employer, by the way, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the main person in the home. So he told me he took it 3 months ago.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And how are their labs looking? Are you doing any sort of diagnosis on these people?
Yeah, so they, of course, when they come in through the emergency room doors, the ERs are still continuing to use the PCR test.
Oh, goodness.
And then they'll do the blood testing thereafter, but they, the PCR tests are still the one because they want the rapid reading. And
yep.
once it comes back positive, then they're basically down on the books as positive COVID patient. And
that decides where
you're going to go.
That's a lie.
Exactly. I agree. Those PCRs were only ever used to diagnose influenza A and B. And then somehow, magically, they're using them to identify COVID, something they've never done before.
And so does the diagnosis stop at that? They're just assumed to have COVID or SARS-CoV-2?
They'll do the SARS-CoV-2 when they do the written report for the testing. That's how it'll come up as positive for SARS-CoV-2. They'll usually end up then following it with chest x-rays because last year we saw a lot of the classic COVID lung, as they referred it to, where
mm-hmm.
you'd see the lungs, and it wasn't just one lung, it was bilateral. By the time they got to us, it was bilateral. It was that, they were just that bad. But the lungs would be, they'd just light up on the x-ray, and they would have been completely full of what seemed like mucus, or fluid, or, you know, there was something going on with those lungs. And after a while, we started seeing the trends. They said some physicians were, don't bother with the PCR test, just take an x-ray. And then they'd just take one look at the x-ray, and they would already know they had the COVID lungs. And that's mm-hmm. what they referred to it on the unit. And so, of course, once you get to that level, you're struggling for oxygenation. They're trying to keep their pulse oxygenation levels up. They're going on high flows of oxygen, then graduating to the BiPAP machine to ultimately going on life support and being placed on a ventilator. And the problem with all of this is that they cannot get rid of the mucus type stuff that's developing in their lungs.
Mm-hmm.
And this is why they end up going on the ventilator.
So what you're seeing now, is it anything comparable to that, or is it different?
It's actually different this time. This time we're seeing, and this is very tragic, but we're seeing intracranial bleeds. We're seeing hemorrhages in the brain. We're seeing seizures and strokes. And we're
it almost sounds
the respiratory.
Yeah, go ahead.
I'm sorry. It's we're not seeing as much of that respiratory component as we were the last time I had worked in that.
This is interesting. One quick thing. I want to underscore this. They're not seeing, Anne is not seeing, the respiratory problems that were the hallmark of the patients just 2 months ago. That's gone now,
yeah.
Replaced with brain bleeds, strokes, and clots. You get it?
Correct.
I think all of you do. Okay, Erica, go ahead.
I was just going to say, it sounds to me, I'm assuming, you know, that I think it's very evident that this is vaccine related. It sounds to me like this is neurosarcoidosis, where you get these infiltrates of, well, immune cells, macrophages and whatnot into the brain. And that can vary. I mean, it is associated with these cerebral venous sinus thromboses that all of a sudden are just very prevalent in these people that have taken the vax, particularly in the women. But yeah, it almost seems as though, I mean, are you looking at calcium levels or ACE levels?
We're looking at all of their, all those kind of levels. We're doing, because they're in the ICU, we're doing daily labs on them. So we're watching all of those levels. And anyone who's on the seizure medications, they're getting labs drawn for that now too. So to see if they're at a therapeutic level with their drugs. But the interesting thing about it is they also have the DVTs as well.
Mm-hmm.
So not only do they have the seizures and the intracranial bleeds, but they're also coming in with DVTs in their arms or in their legs. And it was with every one of these patients. And then there was the patients who did need additional oxygenation. But that, I believe, is because they were now immobile and they were no longer getting out of bed and pneumonia had started to set in.
Okay.
What is your normal treatment of people with mucus-filled lungs? What do you do?
So the typical treatment we would do is we would do steroids, inhalation steroids. If they're awake enough and alert enough to do it, they can hold the apparatus themselves, or you put it through a mask. Yeah, on the ventilator, the respiratory will attach it to the actual tube settings when they're on the ventilator. And then in addition to that, they give steroids. And then they're basically trying to open up those airways. And then I do remember last year when I was working with these patients, they had copious amounts of mucus, but it was exceptionally thick. And the best way I can describe this is it was like the color of cement. So we would be suctioning out this gray, thick mucus. And you'd only get very little bit at a time through this small narrow tube. So the respiratory therapists were trying to lavage the patients as well to see if they could try and break up that mucus. but the classic COVID patients, it was next to impossible if we were getting them where they had bilateral pneumonia at that point.
They didn't have much of a chance. Question, Erica, is the color she's describing the color you'd get with an infection, a bacterial infection? Wouldn't that be greenish more?
Yeah, I would think. I mean, gray, that's really unusual.
Well, gray-white, yeah. This is all new. It sounds like you're, Anne, in utterly new territory here. This is unprecedented.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
No, I was just going to say, if it was, you know, some sort of airborne contaminant that they were inhaling at some point, you know, to turn it, I'm thinking iron oxide nanoparticles or graphene oxide nanoparticles, something like that, that was really irritating the lung and causing damage. Don't know.
What would the source be of something like that? What would the source be of a graphene oxide inhalant? Somebody who is also sick and exhaling?
Well, these nanoparticles are pervasive in just the ambient environment nowadays. I mean, there's no regulation on nanoparticulate in the environment. There's no one measuring it, no one monitoring it. It's known that in high traffic areas, cities, whatnot, there's more of this stuff. And it isn't irritating. It can accumulate in the lungs and do a lot of damage.
And go ahead, Ann. Go.
Yeah, in addition to the level of consolidation in the lungs, the thing about it was we were running blood culture tests on these patients too, and they were coming back positive. They were growing organisms. So we were also treating them with multi doses of different types of antibiotics as well at that time. So there an active infection going on also.
What type of organisms are you talking about in the blood? Bacterial organisms?
But yeah, primarily it would be bacterial because we were using, we were using a couple of different things. Sometimes they treat them for a fungal because if they weren't responding to the bacterial IV antibiotics, they would say, let's try an antifungal. So we were using Unison. We were using Ansef in the beginning. Then we'd go to the heavier doses. Like initially there was vancomycin would be one. That would be a strong drug, and a strong IV antibiotic drug. And they weren't getting any better. But then they would turn around and they would use Flagyl as an IV drug we would use. And they just continued to get sicker. And then the wonderful drug that came on board then was the remdesivir. And so remdesivir was been used. And, of course, then they just went downhill from there.
Well, excuse me, Anne, when Anne says the wonderful drug remdesivir, she's being facetious.
Because for whatever progress we were making with the antibiotics, because we would make some strides where they would actually, their temperatures would come down, we'd be able to take the cooling blanket off, all of the other treatments we were doing. When you started hanging the remdesivir, the whole picture changed, and they would take a nosedive, and they would actually get sicker. And when we hung the remdesivir, and that's all we had to give, most people that we gave that medication to did not make it. They did not survive. After that, they would have been on the ventilator, and usually the physicians are now talking to family saying, they're not responding to the treatments we're giving them. And they would say, you might want to consider you know, talking to people and seeing where what more you want to put your loved one through.
Let me say one thing about that again, and I'm speaking for myself, not Erica, not Anne. I think most of us know by now that remdesivir was a, if not the primary cause of the downturn leading to death for most of those who died last year, allegedly of COVID. It was the remdesivir that turned them down and forced them eventually onto a ventilator and then out the back door to the mortuary. That's the truth. That's my truth.
Yeah.
That's what I've learned. Would you agree with that, Anne, or disagree?
I would strongly agree that remdesivir actually made their clinical situation worse in most of the cases I saw. And in addition to the fact that they may have been on high flow oxygen initially, or they might have been even on the BiPAP machine at night, or maybe they required it during the day. But once you hung that remdesivir, that was a fast track to putting your patient on the ventilator. They actually never got better. They ended up getting worse to the point where they were now intubated and now put on life support.
Out the back door. That's it.
Something changed. Something did change, and it was short lived. Ivermectin came on the scene,
uh-huh.
And we started using ivermectin, and they started seeing some people were responding. Now the people who had a lot of comorbidities. And the odds were against them quite a bit, but the patients who were younger and could fight back, and they started responding to the ivermectin. And we were able to actually take patients off the ventilator and actually get them to a lesser acute unit over time. Now they were still in the hospital for months at a time. Don't get me wrong here.
Months at a time.
Oh yeah. All of those patients were in the hospital for months at a time.
Erica?
Yeah, I've heard the stories.
Once they go on a ventilator, 80% die, apparently. That's one stat that I heard. And if I'm any, I don't know, let me just rephrase this. How frank with the patients' families are nurses allowed to be? Were you allowed to talk to the families about the possibility that this was a result of a vaccine, or are you told to shut up?
Well, I will tell you honestly that if there were other people in the room, you could not be frank with the patients. But if you were the only person in the room, and I was in a room with a patient who was a Wall Street guy last year, and he was on the BiPAP machine at that stage. And he was getting frustrated with the BiPAP machine. It is a very irritating machine to wear, but his oxygenation levels, we couldn't keep them up on just the regular oxygen tubing. So he was requiring that, and he asked me, he says, "What should I do? What should I do? Do you know? Should I?" They're trying to tell me to go on, that I may need to go on the ventilator, and I don't want to do it. And then I said to him, "Then don't, because you still have the right to say no. As long as you can still breathe with, and you can keep your oxygenation levels up with this machine, you do not have to worry about going on the ventilator." So I was working for 3 nights with this man. And I was off work. I had been off. My shifts were done. And during the following day, he ended up becoming unresponsive. And they called his wife, and his they said the only way that, they could really truly help him at this point is to put him on life support. And his wife said, do it, because he couldn't talk for himself anymore. And
is life support, is that an ECMO machine?
No, the ECMO machine is even more invasive than that.
I see.
Yeah, and he was on that too. But so he went on, they intubated him and put him on the ventilator.
Mm-hmm.
And brought him to ICU. He was vented on my unit and brought to the ICU because he was on the step-down unit there. And he was there. And then they started doing, he needed ECMO because his kidneys were shot from all of the medication that he had been given. And then he subsequently died 2 days after that.
Well, you did your best. This has got to be... I couldn't do what you do. Nurses are... Good nurses are heroic. Beyond that, this is amazing. Are you... How many are... The patients you've described and talked about, how many of them vaxxed? How many? Most?
The ones I'm working with right now, 100% vaxxed.
So if I asked you, what is the cause of all of this illness that brought these people into the hospital, what would you say?
I've never seen anything like this in my career. Like, I've never encountered this. I mean, I'm absolutely shocked that I'm seeing this level of illness in patients that are so young and so healthy that... The only thing that has drastically changed is the fact that people have gone and got vaccinated. I cannot find another explanation for it.
Okay, I need to ask one more question. We only have 3 minutes. You mentioned emotional changes in some of the staff, or most of the staff. Please give us a couple of minutes on that. Now, these are vaxxed staff members. They're vaxxed.
Yeah, this is correct, yes. So the people who I would have known that were I was very close to for some time, these nurses who would have been low-key and not so stressed out and would take things in their strides, and because honestly, if you're working in a critical care environment, the last thing you need is a high-stressed individual. So most critical care nurses are really tapped into their field. You know, if you're not going to fit in, you leave the field. So they got vaccinated, but now you see them with short fuses. They overreact to things that they wouldn't normally have done before. They don't laugh as much anymore. I'm not saying that it should be an environment where you should be laughing, but you shouldn't be miserable either. You have sick patients. You should be able to go in and try and give them whatever little bit of joy you can give them. And, those nurses started to change their mood. They were moody. They were, pretty verbose in situations with other staff members and it changed.
Now, we're hearing this same thing. Erica does a lot of research in this field about vaxxed people, not nurses, but vaxxed citizens changing. Their personalities are changing. Are you hearing that kind of thing, too?
I do believe it. Yeah. Sorry, Erica.
No, that's fine. I was just going to concur that, yeah, it seems I guess it's anxiety or aggression, agitation. It seems to be a prevalent feature in these people that have gotten the vax. They're just very, very short-tempered, short-fused, cranky.
Well, okay. Anne, we're out of time. I don't even know how to begin to thank you for coming on and sharing this. And I perhaps would very much like to have you on again if you ever want to. Keep people
absolutely
up to date. Well, thank you. Thank you very much, Anne. Okay.
And thank you for talking to yourself and both Erica. It was a pleasure.
Well,
likewise,
pleasure's
Anne.
Ours.
Yeah.
Okay, Ann. Thank you very much, Ann. We'll talk
thank
again.
You.
Okay.
Thanks. All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
There it is from the inside.
Yeah, it's not a pretty picture, but I think, you know, we knew this was coming.
And we certainly did, and we've been trying to inform all of you about this, and it is, and I'm not speaking for Erica, it is about to get a lot worse. Agree?
No, I agree. Yeah.
Best quick advice for people. We have about a minute. What do they do to stay well? First of all, they don't go in the damned hospital if they're still able to walk
no.
and talk. Stay, that's the worst place to go. Sherry Tenpenny called them the death factories now, and doctors she called murderers. Now, I'm not saying that that's true. I'm just reporting what I heard her say. And I, frankly, just between you and I out there, I tend to agree. Final comment, Erica.
Yeah, I hope people take this seriously. It's easy to, I guess, be casual or lackadaisical about the threat. And I'm not advocating being paranoid or living in a state of fear, but just awareness because, you know, the rules of engagement have changed. I mean, this is clearly a weapon. The cover-up and the fraud that's going on now in trying to force ever more people to take these shots and boosters, it's a runaway train. It isn't going to stop.
No.